One of the most distinguished men of letters in the Western world is, he's probably not expecting me to introduce him that way, but is my guest tonight, Robert Hughes.
I wondered who you were going to introduce that way. I'm very surprised that you did it to me.
Well, let us just consider. You are, of course, well known in this country, well known to all Americans, as the man who for some 30 years ran the art critical pages in Time magazine. Robert Hughes's books, and more or less in the order of publication, have been, and this isn't quite all of them, The Art of Australia, he being a native Australian, Heaven and Hell in Western Art, The Shock of the New, The Fatal Shore, Lucian Freud, Frank Auerbach, both of those well-known artists, painters, Nothing If Not Critical, Barcelona, a book that we discussed, The Culture of Complaint, a book that we discussed, American Visions, and up until just recently, the last one was Goya. And now, a brand new title, Things I Didn't Know. This is a memoir.
It is a memoir.
And it's a memoir of what one would have to call the first half, maybe, or hopefully, the first third of your life.
Well, I think the first half of my attempts at self-remembering, but yes, I guess the first third of the actual period of my life, I never thought that I was going to write a memoir, you see. And then it's a disease that happens to people once they get past the age of 60. Mm-hmm. They feel, at least certainly I felt, that I had to, you know, try and show that there was some order to the house, as it were.
Something else happened to you which may push you towards memoiristic preoccupations even more. That is, towards rethinking your life even more. Namely, you came very close to death just
That's
a few
right,
years
I came
ago.
Very close to dying. And when you nearly die, that is the time when you think, oh my God, you know, can any sense be made of the path that I've traversed?
And you start your book with a dread accident in Australia.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Year is 1999, isn't it? You're near Perth on the west coast?
Somewhere near there, yeah.
What happened?
What happened was that I was making a television series about Australia.
Mm-hmm. The one that appeared in this country titled Beyond the Fatal
Beyond
Shore.
Beyond the Fatal Shore, yeah. And I'd taken the weekend off. And while most of the crew were up in Broome, which is this mining town on the, this pearling town, previous pearling town on the northwest coast of Australia, I had gone south of there a bit because I wanted to go fishing. There is, as you might suppose, wonderful fishing in those seas because there are very few people on that coast and mm-hmm. no industry. So anyway, down I went and hooked up with this friend of mine, a former Australian commando turned fishing guide called Danny O'Sullivan. And we went chasing small tuna just offshore with fly rod, number 9 fly rods, and in an open skiff. Had a wonderful day. And I was a bit tired, though by no means knocked out, by the mid-afternoon. Came back. We had released the tuna we caught with the exception of one smallish 20-pounder and, which we were going to have a sushi that night. And I stuck the thing in a cooler and took off north back to Broome where I was going to meet up with the crew. And I'd only been on the road for about 20 minutes, I think, when all recollection of the trip stops. What happened was that I had collided, for what reasons I still don't know, with a car coming in the opposite direction.
It's a head-on collision.
Head-on collision. No. The other guy going at top speed, I mean, his speedo jammed, you know, from the impact at something like 100 miles an hour. And
you were wrecked. The car was wrecked, of course. And
both
you
cars
were
wrecked, but I was especially wrecked.
Yeah. It took months and months to put you back together again.
Yes, something like 17 operations.
17?
17 operations. I mean, counting minor ones, but still. I mean, there were 17 operations in which I had to have mm-hmm. total anesthesia. And and I was in intensive care for about 5 weeks. During that time in intensive care, I think it's true to say, if it goes on, particularly if it goes on for a while, you really come to know and not understand all sorts of strange stuff that's bashing around in your unconscious mind.
When you can detach it from the hallucinations and the strange reveries induced by the drugs they've given to control your pain.
I had absolutely no idea what was happening, you see.
Yeah.
I couldn't detach myself from these hallucinations and reveries. I knew they had an immediate kind of tangential relation to my experienced life. But I had absolutely no idea where this stuff was coming from.
And usually they take a paranoid turn.
Certainly in my case they did.
Well, and in mine as well.
This happened with you, didn't it?
I was telling you before we came on the air, I had a sudden heart attack and bypass surgery many years ago. But and then I was in intensive care. And there's a lot of pain after that sort of thing. They control you with drugs.
Yeah.
Those drugs induce hallucinatory experience.
They do.
And I told you.
And they maintain them.
Yes, for quite a while. You float in and out of the reverie or of the confusion, but eventually you learn what happened to you and you learn what your real situation is.
And you make some sort of sense of it. I'm not convinced that I made complete sense of everything that my psyche experienced.
But it left you with a desire to make fuller sense of the life you had lived.
Absolutely. And that, I think, is the core of what happened and turned me towards the desire to remember and to write about memory.
I sometimes think of that wonderful line, virtually the last line of Hamlet, as he says, as he lies dying, and he says,
"Go, bid the soldiers shoot."
Well, before that, that's what Laertes says.
That's what Laertes says.
But Hamlet says to Laertes, "Report my cause aright to the unsatisfied."
There you are.
And in a way, that's
a wonderful utterance. That is what memoirs try to do. The problem is, of course, that you wish to report your cause aright to the unsatisfied, but at the same time, you are rarely certain that what you're writing about is true. I mean, think, here you are remembering stuff that took place, but which, did it actually take place like that? Am I certain of everything that I'm sitting down? No, I'm not immediately certain.
Particularly as one searches back into childhood, I should think.
Particularly as one searches back into childhood. The funny thing is, I mean, I don't know whether you experienced the same thing. I believe I remembered things from 30, 40, 50 years ago. I mean, I'm 68 now. I think the more remote an event on which in time, the more remote in time an event which I'm writing about is, the more likely I am to be right about what happened, because it has imprinted itself with that strange clarity which events undergone in childhood sometimes possess. You'd think that the further away they were, the less distinct they would be. But the ones that have survived the process of amnesia generally tend to be pretty good. They're pretty spot on. Whereas I have much more difficulty in remembering precisely things that happened only 20 years ago.
What came clear as you thought over and recalled and began to write recollections of your childhood in Australia?
What came clearest was
my father.
I mean, I think I had shied away from writing. In fact, I know I had shied away from writing about my father, and I'd shied away for several reasons. The principal one was that I didn't want to risk being accused of some sort of Oedipal stance against him. I mean, my father was a very remarkable man. I missed him intensely after he died, which he did when I was only 12. And at the same time, I rather feared him. Or to be precise, I feared something about him, namely that I couldn't live up to the standards that
he was a very manly man with a heroic history.
He was a real mensch.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really was.
A flyer in the First World War.
A flyer in the First World War, and that was not a small thing to be, particularly since he, unlike most First World War pilots, he survived the war.
He had some 10 or 12 German planes to his credit.
Something
that
like that.
Shut down.
That's confirmed kills. Yeah. And then, you know, the number that were not confirmed was larger than that. He went right through the war. Not the whole 4 years, from 1916 to 1918, without getting shot down himself, though many people shot at him. And it was a very peculiar kind of war in some respects for the Royal Flying Corps then. For instance, they weren't allowed to have parachutes.
So you say, and I couldn't quite understand why that would be the case.
Well, it was the case that certainly parachutes did exist.
Yeah.
Because spotters in balloons were equipped with parachutes sometimes. No, the British High Command forbade its line pilots to wear parachutes because it was thought that they would this would reduce their fighting spirit.
Or they might jump out when things got hot, is that?
Yeah, that they might jump out when things got hot.
Yeah.
So they were, in effect, a kind of, you know, English kamikaze, or in this case, Australian kamikaze.
Every so often we are over-punctuated by commercials. This is one such moment.
Okay.
Let's continue talking about your father and his career and your relation with him directly after we pause for this. We are talking with Robert Hughes, the acclaimed art critic, who for so many years ran the art critical pages of Time magazine and has done many very important books, the newest being his memoir, Things I Didn't Know. We're talking about your father, who obviously mattered a great deal to you, but he died.
He died. He
your
died
father loved you, one guesses, but he died. You were only 12 years old.
And I was 12, and I didn't really, therefore, have the opportunity to speak to him as adult to adult. And I could only reconstitute his life and feelings from hints and indirections, so to speak. Because, for instance, I longed for him to tell me about the war.
Yeah.
You know, about this being the First World War. I mean, I knew certain things about what he'd done. He shot down the brother of Manfred von Richthofen, for God's sake, you know. could I get him to talk to me about what it was like up there in that little wooden paper kite with its two machine guns? No. No, it's a fairly common thing among veterans, of course, that they don't like to talk to the young about their experiences because of a probably well-founded conviction that the kid wouldn't understand anyway.
It's a long distance from there to the career that you had, but I found a wonderful way to do some of it, to navigate the territory. I handed you a moment ago a copy of a speech you gave at, was it the University of Melbourne?
The University of Melbourne.
When they gave you in 1995 an honorary degree.
That's right.
It isn't very long. I invite
well, it's
you to
quite long. I
just a page and a half. I invite you to read the whole thing.
The whole thing.
Please.
Okay. This was my acceptance speech at the time, 20 years ago now. No, 10 years ago.
No, 95, 11 years ago.
11 years ago. It has taken me 39 years to get a degree from an Australian university. It's true, I didn't graduate, you see. I am flushed with relief and gratitude. My academic history, I will now confess, has been a sorrow to me and a disgrace to my kin. I enrolled at Sydney University in 1956, intending to do an arts law course and then become a barrister like my elder brother, Thomas Hughes.
That's the brother who went on to be Attorney General.
That's the brother who went
Australia.
On to be Attorney General, yeah. He's now 83, 84. Mm-hmm. My conscious mind had persuaded me that I could follow in his footsteps to the bar and maybe give him some competition, but alas, my unconscious led me to the wrong bar. Released after 5 years in a Jesuit boarding school, I discovered beer, girls, and university journalism. I swanned around the quadrangle in a black duffel coat, a garment designed for deck duty on naval patrols in the North Sea, but ill-adapted to South Pacific conditions. In its left pocket was a black box of Balkan Sobranis, the cigarette of choice among 19-year-old aesthetes at the time. They had gold tips, and one would jam them in a holder while discoursing to a blonde from the eastern suburbs on the superiority of Ronald Furbank to Henry Lawson. In the right pocket was a copy of Jean-Paul Sartre's Being and Nothingness, of which I could not read a word since it was in French. Sometimes I would take out Sartre and leave him on top of a formica table in the pub known as the Royal George, and then place the Sobranis on top, like the cherry on an ice cream sundae. I wrote articles for En Histoire, the student newspaper. I drew cartoons and penned extremely derivative verses. I acted badly in the University Review, and from time to time I condescended to attend a lecture or turn in a paper. It was the fullest year of my young life, and at the end of it, I found, inevitably, that I had failed Arts 1, a course that a fairly diligent amoeba could have passed.
And this is the man who, this is the young man who goes on in his early maturity to be a major art critic, and indeed ultimately considered the major art critic in English journalism.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. I mean, not everybody thought that. However, it's very nice.
Well, lots of
to
people did
bring it up. Yeah, but you see, I was extremely fortunate because I got a go at art criticism without any particular qualifications, and so I was able to some extent to make up my own career.
We'll come to that in a moment. But back to the text. I love this speech.
By that time, I knew what I was going to do. I would go to Paris and be an artist. The rugged de Gaulois Disque Bleu would replace the effete Balkan Sobrani. Perhaps my elder brother would contribute to my welfare on the left bank out of gratitude to for having the threat to his out of gratitude for having the threat to his legal career neutralized. But strangely, he would not. So I decided to stay in Sydney and be an architect like my sister, Constance, who seemed not to mind the competition. I spent 3 very happy years in the Faculty of Architecture, mainly acting in the University Review, writing for En Histoire, which was a student newspaper.
En Histoire qui mal y pense.
En Histoire qui mal y pense. And The Nation, painting extremely derivative pictures, and now and then handing in a Beaux-Arts rendering of the west front of the Parthenon, or a design for a new surf club at Manly in the manner of Le Corbusier. I did not graduate because, after a drunken lunch in 1962 with Alan Lane, the founder of Penguin Books, I was offered my first book contract, a £300 advance to write a history of Australian art. Wavering between virtue and vice, I chose the vice of writing, and such was the end of my academic career. The only building that came out of those years of desultory acquaintance with Ictinus, Bramante, Vanbrugh, and Sir John Soane is a tool shed behind my house on Long Island. The rhythm of its facade and the forthright character of its fenestration have been noticed by some, though not by my wife, Victoria.
Yeah.
Since then, especially in America, I have lived in a world where practically everyone except me has a degree, and sometimes several. I've even jibbed at the hiring of research assistants because they are all more qualified than I am, and I know they know. The professorial glare still has the power to strike me dumb, and I sometimes feel as though I've gotten away with a harmless confidence trick, particularly when I go to Italy, where, because of my job, people sometimes address me as dottore. In the past, I would feel a twinge of guilt from which you have now absolved me. To quote one of Macbeth's henchmen as the bloody Scot learns he has been made Thane of Cawdor, strange honours come upon him, which, like new garments, cling not to their mould, but with the aid of use. Doctor, dottore, Herr Doctor, sounds good. I've been writing art criticism for 35 years, 25 of them in New York, and it is the fate of a critic to make enemies. Every so often, I hear that some aggrieved artist or curator exaggerating his or her own victimhood, as Americans are apt to do, has uttered the prophetic words, quote, "One of these days, Hughes will get what he deserves," unquote. I'm happy and grateful that this university today has proven them wrong.
Wonderful. It's a wonderful piece, dottore. And, dottore, we have to pause just now for an update on the news, and we return to Robert Hughes. We are drawing from his very, very interesting new memoir, absolutely compelling reading, and I've been with it for the last few days. It is titled Things I Didn't Know. And Robert, I find this, which I'm going to quote now to you. These are still your words, but I want you to elaborate upon them or do some explication du texte, as they say in your highfalutin world.
What do you mean, my highfalutin?
Well, the highfalutin world.
My highfalutin world.
The highfalutin world in which you occasionally wander,
okay,
I should say.
Well, all right. Yeah.
You speak of preferring the good to the bad, the articulate to the mumbling, the aesthetically developed to the merely primitive. Here we're talking. You're talking about your preferences in your work as an art critic, and the full to the partly conscious. And you say, I love the spectacle of skill, whether it's an expert gardener at work or a good carpenter chopping dovetails. I don't think stupid or ill-read people are as good to be with as wise and fully literate ones. Consequently, most of the human race doesn't matter much to me outside the normal and necessary frame of courtesy and the obligation to respect human rights. I am, after all, a cultural critic, and my main job is to distinguish the good from the second-rate, pretentious, sentimental, and boring stuff that saturates the culture today. I want to ask you directly, what is the ratio of the good to the second-rate, pretentious, sentimental, and boring stuff?
Well, it's pretty small. But at the same time, what I'm not trying to get at there is some notion that people don't have a right to listen to or be amused by stuff that I personally don't like. But I, you know, my job is to defend quite often stuff that people don't like.
We're talking about the wheat and the chaff ratio.
Well, but not all the chaff is chaff.
Well, it's mid-cult, as somebody once said,
yeah,
is it?
Which contains sometimes stuff that is worth listening to, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing is that what I'm writing about is a particular end of culture, a particular area of culture, whose parameters and standards may not necessarily be those of populist art.
You do this especially focused on pictures, not paintings alone, but paintings is the single largest category in which you've done extensive art criticism.
Yes.
And you find some celebrated modern painters that you think are really doing trick.
Yeah, that's right.
Who are they?
Well, there are quite a few of them. I mean, there are, you know, the one that always comes up in discussion of my work, because I've attacked his work once or twice, is Julian Schnabel. But there are, of course,
well known in England.
Well known in England.
Yeah.
But there are, of course, others. I mean, for instance, is it really unfair to say that Jasper Johns is a horrendously overrated artist?
Strangely, you find him overrated, but you think his near, if not colleague, at least
his exact
contemporary is Rauschenberg. You think him overrated?
Well, Rauschenberg, I don't think he's overrated at all.
Yeah.
But I don't think,
what's overrated about Johns?
People think, or some people think, and write about Johns as though he was this extraordinary intelligence, this sibylline creature who sets almost insoluble puzzles which the truly aesthetically aware have to be able to talk their way through in order to get a rep as being interpretative, as being serious interpreters of art. I think this is, you know, actually nonsense. And the relation between Johns's achievement and his preposterous prices, you know, $135 million for a single painting. Come on, give me a break.
Is that what he asked, or is that what
No, that's what he got the other day.
What painting was that?
It was a painting called False Start, which he painted in 1959, which used actually to be owned by a friend of mine, who then, I guess, is now gnashing his teeth for having sold it for $3 million.
A mere $3
million. A mere $3 million. I mean, my contention would be actually that no work of art really is worth $135 million, and certainly not some piece of stuff.
Well, some of the great masters of earlier periods, including, say, Goya, on whom you've done a book and a television program, I suppose they sell for upwards of $100 million,
don't they? But look, Milt, the thing is that you can, once you get up into that stratosphere of price, the price itself will free. It's like the Medusa's head. It turns thought to stone. It replaces whatever the picture is about, and it annihilates whatever the picture is about, and replaces all discussion of its content or its purpose just with the brute fact of huge figures and zeros on a checkbook. I mean, I'm depressed. I'm really depressed at the kind of freezing effect that this culture of super prices has upon one's perception of art.
Yeah. Speaking of the making of money, it's time for us to pause for some commercials.
Oh, good. That's what it's for.
And back to Robert Hughes. I picked up on the last part of that quotation from this book that I read to you, where you say that your job is to distinguish the good from the second-rate, pretentious, sentimental, and boring stuff that saturates culture today. When I think of popular culture, film, for example, or television.
There's good popular culture. There's marvelous popular culture. There's
crappy
popular culture.
What do you like? What do you dislike?
Well, my God, there's so much. But, you know, for instance, as an example of something I thought was really good the other day, I saw a film of which I didn't have high hopes, actually, but which turned out to be wonderful, which is a film about the Queen of England called The Queen, directed by Stephen Frears, with Helen Mirren, that consummate actress.
She's a wonderful actress.
She is just such a good actress.
Yeah.
See, I love intelligence. If it shows itself in the craft, which Mirren's work does, it is a wonderful thing to see. It just carries you away. It carries me away far more than...
But you
than
know,
it...
only recently there was a BBC production... with her playing Queen Elizabeth again, but it was Elizabeth I.
Yes.
And I thought it absolutely tiresome. They turned it
into... I didn't see it.
They had that very good actor who played Walter Raleigh, but I forget his name, but he's well known. They just turned it into a soap opera, and it was silly.
Yeah, well, that's a pity.
It was beautifully costumed, and you know, the production values were good, but the script was childish.
Well, I got to say that this one on Elizabeth II was not like that at all. It was as sharp as a tack. It was very funny, but you know, subversively funny, not you know, dumb broad humour. And if you're making a film set in that moment in history, a couple of years ago, when Princess Di was killed in the underpass in the car crash, you know, presents limitless opportunities for broad social satire, which actually Frears did not avail himself of. He made a very, very smart, intelligent film about power.
Intelligence is just the word. I love intelligent film, and I see very little of it.
Yeah.
Most of the Hollywood stuff that I see, and I see it mainly on television late at night, strikes me as just unbearably formulaic and dumb.
And yet there are highly intelligent actors and actresses in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, for instance, of Annette Bening, who is a really marvelous actress. And I would go and see anything that she does. And the problem is not in the IQ necessarily of the actors. It's in the expectations that people have of the audience. If you know, it would be very difficult to imagine I'm reading at the moment the second volume of this admirable biography of Orson Welles by...
Simon Callow. Yes.
And, you know, it gives you a fascinating insight into the way that, you know, Hollywood could have somebody who... however egotistic, however power crazy, and all the rest of the stuff that's always said about Wells, somebody who was nevertheless, and perhaps because of these characteristics, a creative genius of high order, and how he just got totally mishandled by and frustrated by RKO. All this stuff is deeply interesting to me, because is it not the case that many geniuses, well, several numerous geniuses, have been frustrated by the conditions of patronage, and you know, do not have the power to make their way in quite the way they would.
Have you seen much of that in your own world? I mean, the world of art, the world of arts journalism. Have you seen some people of first-rate quality who've been squashed by a system they couldn't master?
Not so much in visual arts journalism, no. And I think the reason is that the thing that determines what's up and what's down in visual arts journalism has much more, these days certainly, has much more to do with the market than with the opinions of critics. We critics, art critics, are pretty feeble. We're not really powerful.
You don't affect the market, you think?
You affect the market to a limited degree, mm-hmm. but really the market is made by collectors, it's made by yeah. curators.
Well, you obviously haven't slowed down Jasper Johns.
No.
As a marketable artist.
That would be like shooting a 22 cartridge at a passing blimp. You know, you might hit the blimp. In fact, you could hardly fail to miss it, but it isn't going to make any difference. Oh, you could hardly fail to hit it, but it isn't going to make much difference to the majestic passage of this.
One artist for whom you have great enthusiasm, apparently, indeed you did a book about him, is
Freud.
Is the grandson of Sigmund Freud.
The grandson of Sigmund Freud. Of course, Lucian has always denied that his work has anything to do with the kind of analysis which Freud developed. And I think
but it's always
true.
Naked people lolling around.
Well, that doesn't matter a damn, as you well know.
But mean, it isn't attractive.
You could say the same. You could say the same of Rubens.
Yes, but it isn't attractive. Naked people. It's sort of, it's drawn whole, which is to say, with their sagging skin and their bulges.
That's right. Yeah. Well, no, I mean he doesn't go in for the kind of idealization that past artists of the nude have done.
But then Rubens didn't quite either, did he?
No, Rubens's forms of idealization are again different to those.
And you've written about Rembrandt, and Rembrandt certainly.
Rembrandt's gave us, very different.
Gave us veridical representations of the human body.
Yeah. I mean, Rembrandt's portrayals of old flesh and sagging skin and so forth have actually more to do with Lucian Freud's than they do than Rubens's.
Sure. Yeah.
But again, you know. Rembrandt doesn't have much to do with Freud either, or I should say Freud doesn't have much to do with Rembrandt, because a lot of Rembrandt's work is infused with this kind of, dare I say, highly moral religious conception of the flesh, which is both realistic and at the same time somewhat idealized.
Let me offer you something about what painting, what good painting really is. I wonder if you know the author of this quotation. Painting is poetry that is seen rather than felt. And poetry is painting that is felt rather than seen.
I don't really know what that means. Who is it, by the way? It's not Ruskin.
No, it's about somebody that you started to do a book on but have not completed. It's Leonardo.
It's Leonardo. Yeah, I guess that's right. Leonardo is not big on feeling. You know, there's something peculiarly distancing about a lot of Leonardo's work, particularly his representations of the human form. Indeed, when I set out to write a book on Leonardo, it was that that defeated me. You know,
was
it's
it?
Extremely difficult to feel the kind of empathy with Leonardo that you would like to have in order to write a book about him, because he is so cold and remote. There's a famous incident when, well, it's famous among Leonardists anyway, which sort of gives you something of a clue to this incredibly difficult man. It's a letter that he wrote to his brother. Congratulate you on the occasion. The brother had just been presented with a son by his wife. Now, the sort of congratulatory letter that you would write under these circumstances in the 15th century is not hard to imagine. Leonardo's response was almost unimaginable. He wrote this letter saying, "Dear brother, I am informed that you've been recently presented with a son, a circumstance which I am told fills you with pleasure. On hearing this, I became convinced that I was as far from a right judgment of you as you are from prudence, seeing that you have done nothing other than engender a watchful enemy who will strive with all his energies after his liberty, which cannot come into being until the moment of your death.
Oh, my.
Now, it's a great pity that Sigmund Freud, who couldn't read Italian, was unacquainted with this letter before writing that silly essay on Leonardo and all that nonsense about vultures. Because, you know, you could hardly conceive of a letter which was more out of tune, to put it very mildly, with the, with paternal feeling. I mean, he has a very peculiar kind of remoteness. Whether this is, and this is not a function
and
of
a refined paranoid sensibility.
Yeah, this is not a function of his homosexuality.
Yeah,
it is a function of something else. It's a paranoia all of its own.
Yeah.
And the
it's they'll kill you if they can. Is sort of the general stance, isn't it?
And this is true of some, but not true of all. Now, it's certainly true that Leonardo left no words of affection about his parents, but nevertheless, it's an amazing letter.
Hmm.
And and it's hard to come to grips with a person who feels that way. You know, I mean, I certainly have my own Oedipal resentments and one thing or another, but it would never occur to me that that kind of hostility was the natural order of things between fathers and sons.
Well, that one definition of art by one famous artist produced some fine response from you.
Well,
let me give you another. This is another well-known artist, for the moment unidentified. We all know that art is not truth. Art is a lie that makes us realize truth, at least the truth that is given us to understand. The artist must know the manner whereby to convince others of the truthfulness of his lies.
A lie told in the service of truth. I would presume that that is a late 19th century utterance.
Yes, it is.
But who it is, I really don't know.
He may have uttered it in the 20th century, but he crosses the barrier.
Yeah. Is it Picasso?
It is.
No.
How did you know?
Oh, because I'm so educated.
Yeah, you are indeed.
No, I've sort of read it before, I think. But it's certainly, you know, that again is very tipico.
It's paradoxical. It courts paradox in it.
Well, he loved, in his rare published utterances, making a bit of a mystery.
Yes. Yeah, he's a mystery monger.
Yeah,
about himself.
Yeah, yeah, very much so.
I've sometimes suspected that he's a bit of a fraud.
He is a bit of a fraud, and yet at the same time, he's a real artist. He's not a bit of a fraud all the time. Sometimes he is extraordinarily direct and truthful, more truthful than people wish to sometimes admit. But what is slightly fraudulent about Picasso is not his achievement as a painter, but the reputation of that achievement. Mm-hmm. Because the Picasso industry has been turning the crank for so long that it becomes really difficult to sort out what he did that is of permanent value, or likely to be of permanent value.
Do you know the Picasso sculpture?
The one here in Chicago.
Planted in front of City Hall?
Yeah, the one that's based on his Afghan hand.
Or something.
No, it's based on his Afghan hand.
Well, it was commonly supposed that that's the face of a dog, but others gave other interpretations.
Well,
is it a work of art that commends itself to?
It's a work of art. But then, on the other hand, to call something a work of art is not necessarily to praise it. I mean,
no, I don't like it especially.
To say that something is a work of art is merely to denote its intention. It's not to say that this belongs to a nobler category.
Is it good art? Is it praiseworthy art?
Well, it may or may not be praiseworthy. I don't think it's much of a... I don't think it's the great sculpture that people would like to think it is. But on the other hand, I don't know anybody who really thinks that that's a great Picasso.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very big Picasso.
Well, it was made out of a little model that he supplied.
It was made out of a tidgy little maquette, about the size of a paperclip.
Yes. Well, if he's not a fraud, he's something of a mountebank, though they helped him to be one.
I don't think he's a mountebank, although this continuous harping upon what Picasso performs,
mm-hmm.
The, the guy who can produce an orange from a hat and turn it into a dove. This is a side of Picasso which verges upon mountebankery, saltimbankery. He loved mountebankery.
It's art combined with the art of publicity.
Well, of course, you know, he was the great, you know, he was the great pioneer and master of that. I mean, there was nobody in the 19th century who mastered the techniques of publicity. But you must remember that in the 19th century, these techniques of publicity, this kind of fame, was not available to artists because it hardly existed.
And speaking of publicity, by a quick and rather crude segue, we go to public pronouncements about things of value to purchase and to enjoy. We return to Robert Hughes, a distinguished art critic and general social observer. I had tremendous pleasure years ago when we talked about your book, which was really a critique of and an analysis of American culture and how it's been changing. For the worse, was your view at the time.
Well, not everything is for the worse, but certainly what I was writing about. I mean, the book you're talking about is what was its title?
Don't you remember the titles of your own books?
I should remember the title.
Well, we're going to...
I've published 16...
That was the culture of
the
complaint.
The culture of complaint.
Yeah.
That's right. But you see, things have changed so much since then. I mean, when Culture of Complaint came out, it seemed that, so much public discourse in America was buckling under to a kind of mixture of apocalyptic bullshit number one, and number two, sort of disagreeable, overstressed, phony courtesy, which prevented you from using language that might possibly offend anybody. Well, it was a big, fat target, and it was a lot of fun to do. I mean, I don't think that anybody these days is going to be particularly surprised, for instance, by the mention of the word ebonics. Our problem really at the moment, I think, has much more to do with an excess of tenderness towards manifest superstitions. You know, this is one of the big things, you know, religious superstitions to begin with. But then again, I speak as an atheist. This horrendous, this overwhelming gush of fundamentalist rhetoric, which has so infected the way that people talk and think about politics, is really a big menace now. And I don't think it was the same then. I don't think it was quite as extreme.
I note, merely to note, rather than to engage you in controversy, that I think I disagree with you. In fact,
you do.
I know I disagree with you. Because I think, obviously, I'm not a fundamentalist, and I don't like fundamentalist Bible banging to the obliteration of all other ways of thinking or talking.
Well, neither do I. That's all I'm objecting to.
But I think that is a kind of attack used against American conservatism by American leftists these days, and it strikes me as overshooting the mark by far. But I don't want to get involved in that.
Yeah.
What I do want to do.
Let us note in passing, however, that I'm neither American nor, in my view, a leftist. But anyway, let's go on.
Well, of course you're not. You haven't taken American citizenship. That's
no, I have not. I was on the point of doing so, and then I thought, I decided not to do it because I thought it would be interpreted, which, you know, not without justification, as a public rejection of Australia, which is something that I don't really wish to do.
And you had a little, rather tough go with your native countrymen in
recent
years.
Yeah, I did, because I was given a drubbing after that accident.
It got you into court.
Yes. I mean, that was not really something with my native country. That was the result of peculiarities of law. But you see, I still feel like a mildly patriotic Australian. I'm not fanatical about my Australianness. How can I say this? I was going to say I love America, which I do, in fact. I'm intensely grateful to America for all that it has given me over the last 30-something years. I don't know that it just gave it to me. I mean, I did something to earn whatever I've...
You did, surely.
But the thing is that I also believe rather strongly that, in my case at any rate, the leopard can't change his spots.
I want to turn to something more personal, and this is a very personal book. We haven't talked about it yet, about your own family life. We've talked about your family of origin, but not the family you made.
Well, listen, it's been very disjointed until a few years ago when I met my present wife.
Yes, who was a good wife.
Who was a really great girl.
You had a fine marriage. But I read the section concerning your first marriage before this book appeared. It was published in advance in some journal or other. I forget which. Was it the New Yorker, possibly?
I think it was the New Yorker. Yeah.
At any rate, it was a horrific experience.
Yes, it was.
For you, and rather a horrific read.
Well, it was a pretty horrible experience for me. At the same time, I have to say that I was not innocent of the stuff that went wrong.
The scene is London in the 60s.
The scene is London in the 60s, not necessarily a great scene to be in. And I married an Australian woman there who turned out to be a sort of voracious... she was one of the... she was a kind of flying testbed for every fantasy that swept through the so-called underground in the 60s.
Of course, connubial loyalty wasn't a very important standard in those circles.
It was something to be rejected and shunned, I think.
Yeah.
Because the fear was that if you did exercise it, then there was a lot of stuff out there that you're going to miss out on. Did we have a bad time. Did we ever? And of course, it had the most ghastly effects upon my poor dear son, Danton Hughes, who, because of the psychic wounds that he endured as a result of this, committed suicide a few years ago in Australia. Danny, his mother, who had been a pretty ghastly mother, I'm not saying this in order to establish myself as the paragon of fatherhood either, but Danny died of cerebral tumor in 2002. Danton by that time was already dead. The marriage was a real disaster, and I go into the reasons for this in the book.
How long did it last?
14 years.
That long?
That long. 14 years from first vows to divorce. A long time, but then on the other hand, if I can say this without you bursting into shrieks of laughter, I'm a Catholic. Well,
you were raised a Catholic.
I was raised a Catholic, yeah.
That didn't restrain you from divorce, surely.
Didn't restrain me from fornication either.
Yeah.
It restrained me from theft. Mm-hmm. But the other principal sins, I'm afraid I did not manage satisfactorily to abjure.
You are a product, all the same, of a Jesuit school, and the Jesuit fathers had some real influence upon you.
Enormous.
Just as they had upon James Joyce, who defined himself against them.
Well, without wishing to compare myself to James Joyce, which would be...
It's a similar dynamic, I think.
It's a similar dynamic. Of course, I've always defined myself against the Jesuits. That's part of their subtlety. They get you to do that even after you've got rid of the faith.
We're here to talk about you, not about me, but I can't resist telling you something that some of my audience have heard before. One of the best friends of my life was a Jesuit.
They make very good friends.
This is a first-rate guy. He came to me as a graduate student at the University of Chicago. He had already been in the priesthood for a long time, in the order for a long time, and he was located at a Jesuit university in San Salvador. He got his PhD from us in the psychology department, social psychology at the University of Chicago, went back and became the vice rector of that same institution. And you will remember the occasion when a death squad, while that civil war was sort of still raging, came onto that campus and got the six Jesuit priests who ran it and shot them down.
And he was one.
Ignacio Martin Baró.
My God.
Was one of them.
Yeah.
I had seen him only a few months before that occasion and said to him, I hope you're guarding yourself and taking very close care. And he said, it's in God's hands.
Yeah, well, I guess it was, wasn't it? It was just indeed. One more proof that he doesn't look after you.
Yeah. It is time for us to pause in a moment, but first to invite telephone calls. And we propose to go directly to the phones. Are you all set, Robert?
Yes, I am. If there's somebody on the phone.
Oh, there are, but I just want to be sure you got the volume level at the right point.
Yeah, yeah.
Very good. Then we proceed. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello. I just had a question. I was listening in the car, and I'm realizing who the gentleman is who is your guest, and he's somebody who I've always been fascinated to hear more from because I'm a fan of TV news, and I've read several books about ABC News and history, things like that, and I realized that this was the original host of 2020.
Ha ha, my God, you must be one of the five people in America who still remember that.
I've never seen it. I actually was only just born at that time, but I know one of the things they always said was that people couldn't understand you, but I understand you just fine. But then again, I did go to UNSW.
Well, I am not, believe me, I am not that obscure of voice. That notion that they didn't understand me was rubbish.
Yeah.
What actually happened, without going into it in too much detail, was that I simply couldn't take the format of the show seriously. I was asked to go on it by my old friend, and now alas, late friend, who was the other anchorman,
right?
Harold Hayes, that's right.
And they called you Hayes and Hughes.
Hayes and Hughes. Hi, I'm Hayes. Hi, I'm Hughes, or vice versa. And
what did you do together?
Well, we anchored the show.
Mm-hmm.
We would say, and now we're going to hear from none other than Geraldo Rivera, alas. The fatal moment came when Rivera, I'm not going to get stuck into Rivera at this point.
I don't mind. You go ahead.
Oh, narcissistic lunatic. But anyway, he had gone down, but he was the particular blue-eyed boy of Rune Arledge, who was the kingpin of ABC at the time. And he was more or less given carte blanche on what he could do. So he chose to go down to somewhere in the South, I can't remember where it was now, to do a report upon the dreadful use of rabbits in greyhound coursing, as bait in greyhound coursing.
Uh-huh.
Now, the trouble with this, from my point of view, was that, you know, in Australia, the rabbit has about the same existential dignity as the rat or the cockroach. I mean, they are our principal rural pest. And so we don't have very fine feelings about rabbits. We don't give a damn about them, really. You know, and so there's Geraldo emoting away about this dreadful habit of southern crackers of being cruel to these innocent lagomorphs. And I just laughed. I couldn't contain myself. I thought it was one of the stupidest things that I'd ever come across in my life. And that, I think, set the tone for my eventual...
How many weeks did you last?
One night.
One night was the whole thing?
One night was the whole thing. Do what you will, for one night shall be the whole of the law. And boy, we were out of there. You know, at first I thought, oh, I'm stuck. I'm going to be doing this, you know, sick with despair and fastened to a dying animal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But not at all. They got rid of me like a. And then I found my.
If you're going to fail, fail greatly, I would say.
Yeah, well, I certainly failed greatly there. That was my one glorious night on network television.
Uh-huh.
And then fortunately I was able to go off and do Shock of the New with the BBC, but it did give me some insights into what network television is and could be like, and that's one reason I got to say why I never did anything on network television again.
But you've done a lot of television.
I've done a lot of television, but that stuff.
We go back to the phones. 591-7200. Here is the next caller. Good evening.
Hello, Milt and Mr. Hughes.
Hi.
I was painting tonight at my easel. I flipped on 720, and lo and behold, there Robert Hughes is, one of my very favorite art critics.
God, I think you're a great guy. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. But, Mel, I was I got my MFA in painting at the U of C in the mid-90s. And this was during, I don't know if it's the height, but certainly the nation of art was in the grips of postmodernism at the time, and I suppose still is. And I'm just wondering what your guests' thoughts are on that kind of that movement, which I guess we could date from, I don't know how, where you date it, maybe 1960 or late 50s.
I don't know. What movement do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about the elevation of theory over technique and skill, for example, which I've seen, most clearly in artists like John Curran, although he's trying to learn how to paint, but, the elevation of artists such as those, and art critics who just frankly declared that the only thing that interested them was the idea behind the work of art, whatever the medium.
I think that's a ridiculous, abdication of what the responsibilities of a critic are. And I tell you, when I hear the word postmodernism, I tend to uncock the safety catch on my Luger, as a distinguished German once said.
Wenn man von Kultur spricht, dann sicher ist mein Browning.
Mein Browning.
Yeah.
Goebbels. Seine Browning.
It was Goering, rather. Goering said that.
It was Goering. No. I beg your pardon. It was Goebbels.
No. I thought so too, but I checked it up one night.
And it was really Goering who said it.
Hermann Goering, yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, there you are. Great urban legends mutate in the course of time. To get back to this thing, I mean, art is not theory. Art is praxis. Art is making. Art is painting is a very concrete art. So is sculpture. And the idea that it can be reduced to dribs and spurts of theory and propositions and blah, 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 I don't believe this for a second. I'm not interested in conceptual art. Others can write about it. I can't ever find anything to say in the face of this kind of...
How representational or figurative should art be, or must it be?
Well, there's no sort of scale on which you can see. There's no scale of representational...
Is abstract expressionism a legitimate, significant movement in art?
I mean, look, the thing is that, abstract art is rarely as abstract as people at first think it is.
There's representation hidden behind this world.
Well, there's
like
not
the
any
representation.
That's right. It's I mean, if somebody says here is a completely abstract work of art, it's quite possible that you might see fairies dancing in it. I don't know.
It's a projective stimulus, as they say in psychology.
That's a good... Yeah. That sums it up well.
Well, the Rorschach blot is a projective stimulus.
Yeah, it is.
And so are lots of paintings. Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you, sir.
Very glad to have heard from you. And to another, quickly, 591-7200 is the number. 591-7200. But first, I must ask you, or rather, I must read to you this email. What makes Mr. Hughes laugh, aside from being raised Catholic?
Well, I think whoever that sent it has hit the nail on the noggin. If you're raised Catholic, particularly if you're raised Jesuit, you have to be able to laugh. Otherwise, the world will get on top of you and squish you. What makes me laugh is, apart from anything else, human folly. This is an outrageously funny time to be alive, and if you're interested in the visual arts, it really is.
Didn't Erasmus write a book in praise of folly?
Yeah, that's right, he did. Yeah.
What follies would you praise in the modern world?
I don't praise folly, you see.
What follies would you note in the modern world?
Oh, God, would you give me just about 2 hours to list them by
name?
Well,
I'll give you a few minutes as we pause for a round of commercials. And we return to Robert Hughes. We are drawing from, but hardly doing full justice to, this very important and utterly readable and engrossing memoir that he has just had published, titled Things I Didn't Know. And that is published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. As we go back to the phones, 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I'm a big fan of Robert Hughes. I was just at his book signing. He may remember my voice.
Thank you, madam.
Well, the reason I'm calling is because we brought up some issues during the end of the book discussion.
Oh, that was this evening?
Yeah, that was just this
You're
evening.
The art critic, right?
Well, I'm an art critic, but I started out as an artist, really. And then
some of us did.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm just calling to say, for many years I've been reading quite a bit, and I feel in the contemporary situation I bemoan the loss of your voice as a critique of the present that we need as a counter rate to this tremendous avalanche of covetousness by the media, that the art media and the art writing criticism situation has gotten incredibly narrow, and it has excluded a lot of voices. And
it's too much influenced by the market. This is the big trouble. I mean, what people, I think, you know, the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about is the effect that this hyperinflated art market has upon the way in which art is experienced and discussed, don't you think?
Oh, it's tremendous. It's actually crushed out so much in art education, which is what I've discovered, you know, that's where the seeds are planted. That's where you love to learn to draw or paint or not. And right now, this thing you were talking about, postmodernism, well, here's the chaser, is it's now invaded a lot of these programs, which used to have painting, drawing in the traditional sense, being excluded now.
Excluded in favor of what?
And that's what's interesting. It's like a void. It's empty. And I'm finding this very distressing and very prejudiced in an ideological sort of way.
Well, do you live in this atmosphere? Are you a teacher?
I'm not a teacher because, you know, I love to teach. I come from a family of teachers. But I decided to do writing because I couldn't get a corner on my position within these kind of politics.
But see, I would have thought that, you know, even that is a bit difficult these days because the art magazines are dependent upon advertising, and advertising is dependent upon the market, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it is a very difficult situation for an independent mind to be able to navigate and act satisfactorily within the art world that we've now got.
Oh, absolutely, and that's as teacher or as writer. In fact, I've done mostly catalog essays to sustain myself, in intellectually speaking, not financially, as something that where I could really sink my teeth into something interpretively important. And in your part, I'm very grateful for any tidbits that come our way now from your own critical voice and mine, because we don't have anything now. I mean, there's no center to this.
Well, let me point to another elephant in the living room, so to speak, and this relates to you, Robert, quite specifically, and to people like you. That is, you did for some 30 years major art criticism in a major American publication, Time Magazine, in what is commonly called the back of the book.
I was very lucky to have a forum like that.
And they were very lucky to have you, and you did wonderful arts journalism, and other people contributed as well to a section that really was quite readable and important. If you go to the back of the book now, to the back of Time Magazine, you find, or Newsweek, or U.S. News, the major weekly news magazines, you find nothing of the sort.
Hey, it's mostly fluff. It's
fluff
mostly
or vulgarity.
It's mostly fluff dictated by public, you know, by PR. You
and
know,
it's articles about rap singers, and Lord knows what else.
Well, I'm sure there's good rap and bad rap. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't, you know.
All right.
I don't listen to rap much because it just doesn't interest me particularly. Maybe because I only got one leg, the stuff, you know, what I regret is not that people do articles on rappers, but rather that the quantity of serious articles on, you know, what you might call serious art and serious film has dropped.
On painting, music,
painting,
architecture,
music.
Even on serious film.
Yeah, I mean, Time used to have somebody who reviewed classical music on a regular basis.
What happened? Why did Time, and why have those other comparable magazines, abandoned the arts beat?
Well, I can't speak for the other magazines. I know what happened with Time, which was that for quite a while it had this, you know, we had this great managing editor, Henry Anatole Grunewald, you know, now alas dead, but upon whose bones would be perpetual honor, because The thing about Henry was that he was the son of a Viennese composer of light opera, and he had an intensive musical education. So Beverly Sills, for instance, goes on the cover of Time. The possibility that somebody like the Beverly Sills would be on the cover of Time today is so vanishingly remote that you might as well forget about it. You know, I mean, you'll get Ice Cube or Ice T or whatever the hell the guy's name is cover.
He's been there.
It's a pitiful situation. It truly is. And I think the problem is we're losing so much depth. You know, you see deep things around you, but they're just being washed away by this avalanche of media pop culture. That's why I'm skeptical about we have American culture and history, but there's this absolute intensity of the pop culture dominating things now. That's kind of what I'm sensing and seeing.
Listen, take a great American composer. I'm sure nobody would dispute the greatness of, say, Aaron Copland. Now, supposing that another Aaron Copland were waiting in the wings today, and I don't know whether one is, would he get the same kind of extensive exposure as the great Copland did over his long life? I think very probably not, but I just don't know.
Yeah, I agree. And I think also when you talk about the number of people who are calling themselves artists today, I mean, one reason I'm very selective about who I want to target as writing about is because the situation is so nebulous. It's like sifting through to try and find the few needles in the haystack, practically.
Yeah, well, it takes no more than one needle to make a haystack.
Well, my final words to you are the ones that Mayor Figuerella LaGuardia gave when I was a little boy in New York. Patience and fortitude.
Patience and fortitude. Forward.
Well, I'd never join the postmodernists, and I have to agree with you totally on that.
Hey, I don't even know what a postmodernist is, and 20 years down the line, nobody's going to care what one was.
Exactly.
And we thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.
The number 591-7200. Some lines are available if you want to get in on this. Now's the time to make your move. 591-7200, or for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And you are next on the air. Good evening.
Yes, sir. Most interesting fellow, this Mr. Hughes. I wanted to ask you about actors, since you were talking about them earlier. But before I do that...
About actors.
Actors, yeah. Are you aware that your fellow Australians are very successful at this Texas Hold'em poker?
Texas Hold'em poker? Yeah, there was a poker champion from Australia.
Yeah, more than one. Anyway, the actors are Kenneth Branagh. They once said about Meryl Streep, you could watch her acting or see her acting. I get the same feeling about him.
Well, he's not Australian.
No, I understand that. He's English. I'm asking you about him.
He might be Australian almost, but there we are.
The other one is Paul. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name. He's French. I think his name is, first name is Daniel, second name Auteuil, Auteuil. Do you happen to know his work, and particularly a movie called The Lost Son?
No.
I recommend them to you.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
And we thank you, sir, for the call, and we will pause for a last round of messages and directly back to Robert Hughes. The book that we've been drawing from, but we've hardly plumbed its depths, is Things I Didn't Know, a memoir published by Alfred A. Knopf and Company. And our phone number, 591-7200. There's room if you want to join us. Move quickly and you will probably get through on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, when I was in school, we had to do a project where we had to interview people on campus, and the very simple thrust of the project was to ask people to give us their definition of art itself. I wonder if Mr. Hughes could do that, and I also wonder if he could tell me what he thinks is happening to, I don't know how he even express it exactly, but he said something about it when he talked about what's happening in Time magazine to the whole arts section. Is what do you think the current political climate has to do with the I don't know if the right word is degradation, but to the way that the feeling for art in the, you know, arts for art's sake, ars gratia artis, is like today?
That's the longest question that I've ever been asked, and I can, you know, and I'm not going to be able to give it a short answer.
Well, that's great. I'd love to listen to you talk. I heard you on an NPR show a couple days ago or last week, and it was one of the best things I've heard in a long time. So.
Well, you're very kind. However, I have to say that I don't think the present political situation has very much to do with the present state of the arts. I think that what happened, particularly what happened in the 1990s, late 1980s, when the great Republican assault on public funding of the arts took place, this effectively decoupled the public culture of the country from its political culture, and it stopped cold and dead any possibility of a continuous and fruitful, harmonious sort of relationship between arts and politics in America. From then on, they started to become necessarily adversaries. And then, you know, the whole thing just collapsed. I mean, because it was a phony issue to begin with, you know, this idea that you could run a conservative revolution based on a fear of Robert Mapplethorpe, for God's sake. You know, that is the sort of genius idea that has a half-life of about 5 minutes.
But now that's an excellent point, because it sort of goes to my question. You know that probably most people, and I'm not even sure I would stand on this too, is do you consider his work art?
Yes, it's art, but it's not very interesting art. It's very derivative art. I mean, I knew Mapplethorpe when he wasn't Mapplethorpe, so to speak. And I mean, I'm talking about, you know, the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never thought that Mapplethorpe was a great photographer. You know, I've always considered him a facile, rather derivative, very derivative, actually, artist, you know, whose work takes up on a lot of elements in earlier photography, and particularly, you know, from certain photographers in the 1900s.
Well, how does something get to the point where it strives perhaps to be art, but it doesn't quite get there? Or, as you said, it's art, but it's not great art, it's not good art. Can something be art but be bad art?
Yeah, sure. Listen, you can call anything a work of art. Calling something a work of art is not pronouncing a value judgment about it. This is a peculiarly American kind of fantasy, that to call something art means that it's good, or that it's interesting or intelligent or fantastic.
Well, that moves me. Let me thank the caller. And that moves me, Robert, to put a kind of a challenge to you, or at least an annoying question.
Annoy away.
In your own taste, and for what reasons, do you choose certain great artists as particularly worthy, as particularly fulfilling for you as a viewer?
Because their work has an intensity.
No, but I want you to mention them and to tell me why. Particular person.
Oh, you want me to make a baseball team?
I suppose.
I hate doing that.
Do you?
Because, first of all, it would be a very long list of names. And secondly, they wouldn't necessarily have much in common. I mean, what, for instance, does Michelangelo have in common with, say, Joseph Cornell? Nothing.
Well,
except that there's a certain kind of...
He didn't play with boxes.
No, he didn't play with boxes, and neither did Joseph Cornell draw particularly good biceps.
Yeah.
I mean...
Let me put it another way. I'm going to try to get an answer out of you. Suppose we're putting together a book of 100 worthy artists that we want people to know about, that we want kids to see. Who would be some of the essential people in that book?
Oh, great God.
Cornell and Michelangelo are two of them, I presume.
Yeah, but I mean, look,
can't be done.
It really can't be done. No. And it's not a very interesting publishing idea either.
Uh-huh.
You'd have a lot of difficulty selling that particular one to a publisher, unless you made a prior agreement that the book could be rather...
Put it another way. What famous, well-known, rewarded, quote, artists are to be excluded from that body?
Well, again, you know, you have a... it's like the guy who stops by the road and says to the peasant, "Where can I go and have a pee?" And the guy waves his arm and says, "Monsieur, vous avez toute la France." Sir, you got all of France. I mean,
I thought you were going to give me another one. The guy in New England who stops and asks the man sitting on his porch, I'm going to Boston. How do I get there? And the answer is, you can't get there from here.
That's a famous American saying, isn't
it? Yes, it is. Yeah, it is.
Well, listen, I've never been much of one for making these kind of batting lists. I really haven't.
All right, then I'll just settle for another caller. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a question, man, for Robert.
Yes.
So I've been thinking, a friend of mine, the two of us lately, have hatched this idea sort of in the legacy of people like Kirchner, who came up with fake critics, you know, to have a laugh and promote their own work. And I thought perhaps you would, maybe you'd take personal offense to this, or, you know, you'd have some kind of some witty anecdote about this. Frank Seibold's his name. You think that's a believable name?
Frank Seibold?
Yeah, do you think that's a believable name for a bogus critic?
Probably, yeah. It depends on how bogus the stuff is.
If it's, that's the trick, I suppose. I mean, we hyphenated, we put his last name Mies, Seibold Mies. It gives it a little more...
What does Seibold Mies do exactly?
He's a non-existent art critic, right?
He basically just writes raving reviews of our own shows.
And shows in which you are the contributing artist, is that case?
That's right.
And whose praise, therefore, you would be the beneficiary.
Yeah. I thought perhaps you had had some kind of knowledge about this. Some people have done this in the past. Just mining for
yeah, but they, really. they weren't hoaxes that lasted long.
Well, have some critics been bought? Is that considered?
Oh, are you kidding?
No, just asking. I'm not kidding.
Of course they have been.
Really?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, it was always assumed in France that, you know, if you wanted a good review, you had to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, critics were very badly paid. The only way to ensure perfect honesty in an art critic is to pay him or her a great deal of money. But, you know, the problem is that you also have to have critics who don't collect.
In this book, you give some judgments of particular, of not only of artists, of painters, but of writers. And apparently two men who had considerable influence upon you were Cyril Connolly and George Orwell. Now, of course, Orwell would have been before your time, but I gather you knew or encountered Connolly in London.
Yes, I did. And we weren't friends. We weren't enemies. I mean, he was somewhat out of my league.
Yeah.
The guy who I really admired as a writer and who really had a great effect upon me was Alan Moorhead.
Yeah. Well, he kind of got you out of Australia, didn't he?
He got me out of Australia. It was Alan who always seemed to me to be the beau ideal of professional conduct in a writer. And he not only gave me the impetus and the, what you might say, the courage to leave Australia, but also he just seemed like a sort of father figure whom one could safely and intelligently imitate.
His two great works, I think, widely known to the public, are his two books on the Nile.
The Blue Nile and the White Nile, yeah. Magnificent pieces of popular historical reportage. I mean, Alan was really, really good. I've never quite understood why his work has fallen somewhat out of currency, I guess because he's been dead for rather a long time. But if you want to know how to write really good declarative prose, I would tell anybody out there that Alan's the man to read, one of the men to read.
Is Orwell another?
Absolutely. But the thing is that what Orwell was doing was something other than what Alan was
doing. He was doing political writing, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, Orwell was a great polemicist.
Yeah.
Alan, and, you know, by no means contemptible novelist either. But Alan Moorhead was a superb describer of historical events. And and since this is such an uncommon gift, I seized upon him in the way that the baby duck knows by looking at its mother's backside that it is a duck.
Imprinted on her.
I imprinted on Alan, true. And he knew. And he didn't mind. He was generous to a fault.
Who else has been that influential or close to that influential in shaping you?
Well, oh my goodness. Oh, Tennyson, I'm a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch where through gleams the untraveled world, whose margin fades forever and forever as I move. You remember that from, you know. I mean, I have to some degree been influenced by just about every good, serious writer that I've ever read. I mean, and often in ways that are incomprehensible to me. I mean, for instance, one of the writers I most value is Octavio Paz, and yet I'm not a poet. You know, another writer who, you know, had that kind of rather magical and liberating effect upon me was a great Catalan essayist called Josep Pla, P-L-A.
Of course, you are an historian of Catalan culture, and your book on Barcelona is a great celebration of Catalan culture.
Yeah, indeed it is. It's meant to be. You see, what fascinated me about this place, which I only really got to know when I was in my 40s, was that it has cultures which are regarded as eccentric or provincial sometimes have a peculiar vitality which so-called mainstream cultures don't possess. And I think one of the reasons why I seized with such avidity on Catalonia was that it reminded me in some ways of Australia, but it wasn't Australia.
It's interesting you remember that one of the great works by George Orwell is titled Homage to Catalonia.
And the political aspects of his homage were valuable. Yeah. I mean, Orwell had no Catalan, and I think he'd read very little. And
he was there during the Civil War.
But he was there during the Civil War. He was a witness to tremendous events, and he wrote about them with great honesty and insight.
As you have done in your new memoir, Things I Didn't Know. Our guest has been Robert Hughes. It's been a great delight to have you here again. I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great delight to be here, Milton.